This is Steve Densley Jr., and this is the Mormon Faircast. In this episode, I speak with Steve Goodwin, who was the project architect on the Nauvoo Temple. In this interview, he shares his experiences researching the original design of the temple and seeing the project through to its finish. He also shares his insights regarding symbolic aspects of the temple and the way in which modern temple architects approach symbolism in their designs. Steve Goodwin, welcome to the Mormon Faircast.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Now, you were the project architect on the Nauvoo Temple.
That's correct.
You know, I remember taking my family to Washington, D.C., and whenever I go to Washington, D.C., I love to see the Smithsonian Museums. But when we went on that occasion, you know, I was excited to bring my kids there and go see the American History Museum, and it was closed. And so the Smithsonian, you know, knowing that, you know, a lot of people come just to see those museums, and the American History Museum in particular, had put together a smaller exhibit that they housed in the Air and Space Museum, and it was kind of the greatest hits of the American History Museum. And I thought it was so interesting because it was a lot of fun to see what they had pulled out. You know, you got Abraham Lincoln's top hat and George Washington's dentures and, you know, some of these really iconic things from American history. And they had a small exhibit within this larger exhibit of the most important things from the Smithsonian's American history exhibit. And it was this collection of things from American religion. It wasn't a very big exhibit, but, you know, when you turn the corner and you saw it there, the biggest thing that they had, just the center of this exhibit, was a sunstone from the Nauvoo Temple. And it really struck me how the Nauvoo Temple is not just near to the hearts of Mormons, but it has a place in American history and a place in the American religious landscape. A lot of people, I think, are interested to hear your perspective on what it took to go and rebuild the Nauvoo Temple. But why don't we talk first of all about your background as an architect? How long have you been an architect?
Well, I graduated from the master's degree program at the University of Utah in 1994. I was licensed a few years after that, and so I've been practicing architecture for about, you know, almost 20 years now. About 15 of those years have been licensed as an architect.
And what kind of projects do you work on?
I've worked on quite a few little projects that most people won't be aware of, but of note maybe beyond my work on temples, which has been kind of the main focus of my talent and my output of work, is some work on higher education at BYU-Idaho campus, work for many of the local school districts here in the Wasatch Front, and some special projects for the LDS Church, including the Tabernacle on Temple Square, the Joseph Smith Memorial Building, and some things and some other remodels and some smaller work. But the main bulk of the work has been LDS temples.
Now, people who have been up to the BYU-Idaho campus recently, I think they'll be impressed to know that you were the architect on that,
the new auditorium.
The auditorium there that looks a lot like the church conference center.
Yeah.
And then also the student...
The man-wearing center there. Yeah, I was one of several. I mean, these projects are so massive. I mean, especially the auditorium that were put up with, you know, many architects. And you know, some projects, it can be one or two people. On these projects, they can upwards to 15 to 20. So I was privileged to be a part of that team.
Well, in addition to the Nauvoo Temple, what other temples have you worked on?
Briefly, when I first came on to the company which I worked for, FFKR Architects in Salt Lake City, I worked on the Vernal Temple right as it was finishing up. It was probably one of the only temples at that time that was done by a private firm outside of the LDS Church. And since that time, of course, we did the Nauvoo Temple, a brief project work on the Harrison or White Plains, New York Temple. The Draper Utah Temple, Kansas City Missouri Temple, the Brigham City Utah Temple, which is going to be finalized this fall, a beautiful project I'm very proud of, and then of late the Hartford Connecticut Temple. you know, each of these projects are individual and are unique. And there is a little bit, there is a lot of creativity, but the bandwidth is pretty narrow. And believe it or not, that allows for a lot of creativity and output. And you can do a lot of things with that, but it's not about you. It's about the temple. And I think when we think in terms of that, I think we make the building type, the temple itself, the main success story, not me as an architect, me as the artist. Whenever I put my own agenda above that of the Lord's, I think in every aspect we fail. So this is definitely something where we're outputting our creativity to make the temple a success. And those, and I think when you look around in the churches on the website or all the temples that are around the world, yeah, there's similarities. Everyone knows what an LDS temple looks like. I mean, even if you've never seen one before, you come to a city you've never visited before, you will say, I wonder if that's an LDS temple, because they have that feel to them. And there is a certain spirit about the temple. And those are all intended. The design of these projects are made in such a way that are promoting the best aspects of the temple, but at the same time trying to be as unique to that place we're building it as.
So when you are working on the design of a temple, what do you do as an architect to try to bring in the spirit of temples and temple worship into your design?
On a personal level, I think those who work on the temple, at least our firm, for the most part, are Latter-day Saints. Not all of us that are on the team are, but those who do work on it know the importance of the project, what it means to them. I think personally, it's for me, Steve Goodwin, it's a very, very personal thing. I find it I'm very fortunate to have these wonderful projects to work on. They're once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. And for me, spiritually, it's an opportunity to express my love for the Lord and my testimony of what I am as a member of the church, as well as a person who's been talented and trained enough in this field to be able to produce what we can. So I prepare myself like many members do. I read my scriptures. I attend the temple regularly on my own as a member of the church. I hold family prayer. I try to keep myself worthy at all times. In these processes, there's nothing that we are asked to do that's any different than any other responsibility a person has in their workplace environment. There's no instructions for any special need for prayer or for scripture study. Those are not ever given out. Those are a personal thing. So I can answer as Steve Goodwin, as a person, that I know it does help me out.
You know, a lot of the things that people look for when they're going to the temple. Now, of course, in the ritual of the temple, there's a lot of symbolism in the clothing that we wear. There's symbolism, and in the buildings themselves. You know, if we go to the Salt Lake Temple, there's a lot of obvious symbolism in the architecture and on the stones. It doesn't seem like we see that as much with modern temples. What has been your approach as an architect to symbolism in your designs?
Well, it's one I get asked a lot. And when we finished up the Draper Temple, I had a lot of people ask me, well, what does this mean and what does that mean? And frankly, it's we're asked specifically not to adorn the temple with symbols outright or other things. We will sometimes approach a temple with certain elements that are local to the area. For example, on the Hawaiian Temple, where we did the remodel on that, I personally didn't work on that project, but our office did, and I know that for some of the motifs and details in the temple were of Hawaii, so the koa plant and some of the local flowers and stuff found itself in some of the architectural details and some of the building. But they were...
Well, in the Draper Temple, it seems that there's a sort of a seagull lily motif that you can see in some of the glasswork and...
Yes, okay. Very much so. I mean, like you say, there are those items in there that will be more kind of natural, but there was no intended story to tell. Temples of history, of course, are rich in symbols, and you know, I'm probably not qualified to speak about what everything means on that. I think it occupies a lot of people's minds. But one of the things I tell people a lot about is I think there's this idea that maybe there's something that they understand and know that's specific that they found out that no one else did. And I don't think that's the right mindset to approach the temple on. And those things, I think, distract from what actually we're going there for in the first place. There's nothing unique and unknown. I think the Lord wants us to understand what the temple means. And to hide meanings into the temple, I think, is a distraction to the patrons who go to the temple. That's my personal take on it. All we've been asked to do as architects is not to embellish the temple with maybe these kind of strong symbols of the past that the church has been aligned with.
So it sounds like, I guess, your view of why that is that there is a conscious effort in modern times not to distract people from the, you know, importance of the ordinances that we're doing.
Correct.
In the temple.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I guess, you know, draw their attention away. I mean, maybe, you know, almost drawing the attention to the architect.
Right. And there's been examples of that. They want to make sure these are beautiful buildings. But if we start making it about the architecture, then I think in some regards we've lost the purpose of why we're designing these buildings. I mean, there's always this fine line where we're walking on of making sure that what we design doesn't become a distraction to the patron. And I think as we get more along in time and more sophisticated, there's opportunities to explore those items and those ideas. And they're done with under a great amount of scrutiny. And in some regards, maybe we do try to introduce those ideas to those we work with. But if they recognize them something as like we were speaking about, as a distraction, they'll immediately say, let's pull away from that. Let's not do that. Let's see what else you can do for us. So there's this always a constant ability of trying to make these the most beautiful spaces on earth, but yet not make them so over the top that now it becomes about so-and-so's work.
About the building.
Yes.
Instead of about the work that goes on in the
Correct.
Building.
Correct. So it's a fine line. It's very difficult.
Right. Now, you know, I've heard this. It's probably, you know, faith-promoting rumor that I think it's the San Diego Temple. You know, there's a recurring motif that you can see there of you've got, you know, these squares that are offset so that, you know, it's almost like an eight-pointed star. And that, you know, it's very clearly there in the design, and that at some point somebody figured out that this was the same symbol that was used anciently to symbolize Melchizedek. And, you know, it seems like that somebody tried to track that down and find out if the architect had intended for that motif to actually point to Melchizedek. Yeah. Do you know anything about that?
Well, probably similar stories you've been told. I don't think specifically for those I work with, we ever had those conversations. I mean, even in floor plan, the temple is based on kind of large squares as well. And I visited the site and it's all over the place. Some of the stories I've heard, and I don't have anything to confirm it, is that the architect didn't intend that, and that there were others that came in and said, this is what the meaning is. But I couldn't...
And so it was almost just, you know,
by accident.
Coincidental that the architect did that, and then other people said, hey, did you know that this is actually
Correct.
A symbol of Melchizedek?
Well, that happens all the time. For example, in the Vernal Temple we've done it since then. I know the architect I work with, one of my employers, Roger Jackson, one of the main architects for these temple projects, when we first worked together on the Vernal Temple, there was a simple five-petaled wild rose. It was just very elegant, something that I think to us as designers thought, oh, this is a beautiful little element. We'll put it in the design. Well, a lot of the members would come away saying, oh, that's a five-pointed star when you really look at it. Is there any intention of what you wanted? And I says, we didn't mean anything by it. It was a simple rose to us. And so I think people want to place meaning to the things that they have. I think maybe historically there was attempts to kind of express those things on the temples. Personally, I believe as a culture we've evolved enough that our language has become very, very exact, very precise in this discussion. I think we've added a lot to the language that maybe our forebears didn't intend. And I know that graphically speaking, Historically, those stories were told to individuals through graphic means. And you go to church, you see the on stained glass windows the story of Christ and his life and stories in the Bible, or when people were more illiterate. And I think as times have been more and more modernized, those symbols have such varied meanings. And some individuals adopt those meanings and twist them and make them evil. A great example of that is the swastika, whereas anciently the Babylonians, all the ancient cultures used the swastika, the Irish, used it as a symbol of good. And I think even Hitler intended it, because it was a positive symbol, used it for his own purposes, but by adoption, he made it evil. So whenever you see that symbol today, everyone thinks of those things as evil. And thereby, some of the symbols that we see anciently on temples, like a five-pointed star inverted, a lot of them adopt that in the occult. But historically, early members of the church had no intention of that early meaning. But unfortunately, a lot of the critics of the church apply that meaning in those contexts. And it's a hard discussion to go away. So therefore, the way to get away from those conversations is by not even adopting them on the temples at all, because it distracts from what we're doing on the temple. And because the symbols carried varied meanings and specific meanings that people take away from personally, I think that becomes a distraction to why we're doing the temple.
Now, it may be then that early saints needed these symbols on the outsides of the temple for some reason that was specific to them. Maybe we don't need it as much today. I guess, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think in some regards, that's my personal take. I think as a culture, we adopted ourselves through symbols and graphic means. When I look at my ancestry, a lot of my ancestors were farmers, simple folk. They probably had a third grade education. My family, I'm the first member of my family to have a graduate degree. And that's a big deal for my family. But I know when you look back, most of my forebears were simple folk. And their education wasn't as high as maybe ours, the quality and standard of life that we enjoy today. I think this is a story that we see very frequently today, is of coming up in life and being able to promote and push our children to do things that we never did as adults. And it was my parents' experience, and I know it was their parents, and so on and so forth. So we get back to the historical time where my ancestry, my forebears were early pioneers. And with the stories I heard and told about, these were simple folk, people of great humility. But I didn't come from stock that were educated. And so I'm putting together my own thinking on this, but I think as time goes on, symbols unfortunately carry a lot of inherent meanings that I think were unintended.
Well, yeah, some people, you know, maybe that's more of a recent phenomenon where especially enemies of the church are trying to point at things and say, aha, you know, you guys are worshiping the devil,
right,
because you put an inverted star on the Nauvoo temple.
Right.
And you're the architect on that building. What was your intention of putting an inverted star on the Nauvoo temple?
Well, of course, when we're looking at the Nauvoo temple, that's a different situation in that we were trying to recreate what was lost. And so we didn't think about any of the symbology other than the fact we were recreating what was lost. And we did a very laborious work in trying to recreate those very very things that were lost. And so we look at the inverted star on the Nauvoo temple. At the time, I had since I was back there with my family, I was the on-site architect. And Desert Book had this camera, which I think if many remember, they could go to Desert Book's website and be able to view the construction of the building. That was a very novel thing, and a lot of people were able to share in that experience and seeing so-and-so working on the site, or, oh, look at there's some stone going up. Oh, there's the Angel Moroni. And so I think these are some images that a lot of us remember back to that time period. One of the main questions was, what about this inverted star?
Now, when we say inverted star, just anybody who doesn't know, we're talking about what's commonly referred to today as a pentagram, with the one of the points of the star pointing down. That's what we mean by inverted, and commonly used by heavy metal rock bands,
right, and the occult,
and the occult, and And so there's that connotation to it today, like a lot like what you mentioned about a swastika,
right,
where if you see a swastika today, there was a swastika outside the Provo Library on the, I don't know if it was just, if it's just a pedestal or if it used to be a fountain. But, you know, when that was built in the early 1900s, I think.
Yeah, before Hitler.
Before Hitler. And right, you know, there it is. And so when they're restoring the Provo Library, there's this discussion about, should we remove the swastika? Will it be misunderstood? Did you have any kind of discussion like that about the star?
Yeah, and I'll give you my interpretation. I know there's been others, and I know there's even some articles on the wiki site for FAIR that we've talked about and we've shared. They're maybe slightly different than what I had thought about at the time. I had had some conversations with others who were smarter than I. So this is someone who's thought about it, because it doesn't typically arrange itself in the way that people think about the sun, moon, and star, which are symbols that we use for the plan of salvation in regards to the three kingdoms of glory. We have the moon on the bottom, the sun in the up on the top of the column, and we have stars above it. It doesn't kind of go, I mean, this kind of star, moon, sun kind of idea. So I don't think the originators probably had that in mind. Personally, I had a thought back then, and this is just Steve Goodwin talking, that there was more of an Abrahamic kind of look at the world. When Abraham was looking at writing about his relationship to God, where he stood and where God was, he's here on earth, God is in the heavens. In between us, we have first the moon, then the sun, and then the stars of the firmament beyond that. So it could be this idea that looking at where we are here on the earth to where God is there, that's one way of looking. That's what the way I had originally thought of it. In the FAIR wiki site, there's some articles where it talks about John the Revelator's vision of the last days, and recorded in Revelations in chapter 12. It talked about a woman with the sun upon her, with the moon at her feet, and seven stars above her head. Of course, we know from the Doctrine and Covenants he's talking about the churches at the time. But that's a wonderful illusion of, you know, what the church is today. So it could very well be an expression of Revelations chapter 12. And I would accept that wholeheartedly, and I think that might make a lot of sense. And it kind of goes further when you look at this inverted pentagram, or this star, this pentagram with the point going downwards. There is one of the main stars that people are looking at, is it's actually an elongated ray, almost like it's moving upwards. And that, if you read in Revelations as well, John records the Savior saying, "I am the great and morning star." And a lot of the times the Savior had the allusion to the planet Venus, which is this morning star or the evening star, however you want to look at it. He calls himself the morning star. And so this kind of idea of it rising up is this kind of ascending kind of quality, could have been an allusion to the Savior. But this is personal thinking, and I'm not alone in this. It appears that there are others that have thought the very same thing. So what could be very positive and very beautiful kind of a symbology of the Savior in this kind of representation of the star, of course, is being distracted by Satanists, occult, and the pentagram. And therefore, a lot of the enemies of the church making a conclusion that we're devil worshippers, which is...
Right, and at the time that the Nauvoo Temple was built, the pentagram, or the five-pointed star, and an inverted star, was not used by anybody as a symbol of the occult. And so, to some degree, what we're doing here is we're kind of speculating about what they may have thought at the time.
Yeah, we don't know.
But... you know, if it's not being used by, you know, heavy metal rock bands in the mid 1800s, or by Wiccans, or, you know, the Church of Satanism, then clearly that could not have been what was intended by the saints in Nauvoo.
So unfortunately, this is the problem with symbols: is the intention of the people that created them aren't always interpreted by the people that view them. And so I think this is one of the discussions that, why we try to avoid those in modern temple building. It becomes a distraction to why we're there in the temple, where the temple ceremony is a beautiful and more instructive manner, helps us understand our Heavenly Father's will concerning His children.
When you think about the meaning of the Nauvoo Temple itself to the modern church, What's the significance of rebuilding that temple? Why do you think that was done?
Well, of course, I probably share this feeling with many members of the church. I was one of many that were there on that Sunday conference in 1999 in April, where President Hinckley made the announcement. I mean, it was electrifying. I mean, it's one of those events where I remember where I was. I remember how I was feeling. Of course, I'd never been to Nauvoo prior to that time. I knew I had an ancestor that lived there. And what it meant to me, I knew it was something lost that the church never could regain. It was this kind of scar that remained there. It was sensitive to many of us. We felt the pain of the early saints. We knew, we read their stories. And I think the consciousness of the church was there was something about our history that was taken away from us that we could never really regain. And it was the only experience of a temple that was taken away by violence. Since that time, we've not had an experience where a temple has been that situation. So it's kind of like this idea of atonement. We were able to actually be able to repair something that was lost to us. And I've thought about it since, and to me, I think that's why it had such a heavy effect upon all of us. We were so interested in seeing those things that were taken away being brought back again.
So tell me about the temple itself. We know what the outside looked like. What about the inside? How much do we know about what the inside of the Nauvoo Temple was like originally?
Well, when we look at the Nauvoo Temple, what it was like, we have some good precedents to that, in that the early saints, had already built a temple before this in Kirtland. And after Kirtland and Nauvoo, when the saints arrived in Utah, the very next temple they built was the St. George Temple. Although we know about the foundations for the Salt Lake Temple being built, it was 40 years in the making. St. George was a couple of years after the saints had arrived there in the area. They were immediately building temples. Well, St. George followed the same pattern as Kirtland and Nauvoo. And, of course, we have some archaeological evidence. We have journals. We have a fraction of the drawings from the original architect, William Weeks. And from that, we were able to piece together what we thought the temple looked like. So when we were approached when the announcement was made, we sought out our contacts at the church. We were lucky in the opportunity to be able to win the contract to produce historical as-was documents. So something that never existed other than scant drawings that William Weeks left, we were able to put together a set of documents that describe what we understood of the temple at the time. And so we understood that it had a very similar appearance to the insides of the Kirtland Temple. Basically, two large assembly rooms on two floors. So you would enter into the space, it would feel like a sanctuary or a chapel space with these kind of New England-type pews. They were built kind of warming booths of sorts with pews in them. And the early saints were very detailed in their descriptions in the journals. So if this is a plug for writing journals, it's probably the best one I know because it saved our biscuit many times when we went through here and looked at it.
If we look at the Kirtland Temple, that maybe gives us an idea of what the interior of the Nauvoo Temple would have looked like. Now, the Kirtland Temple, it's very much, sort of a large church building, meeting house type of a situation. Is that how the Nauvoo Temple was usually used?
Yeah, it was. So those who have been to the Kirtland Temple can remember that as you enter there's these large pulpits on either side with these pews in the middle. It was the very, very same way. So the main floor of the temple, which, was the entire space inside the temple, was this very plan. And there was a second floor above that had the exact same kind of look and feel as well, although the main floor was more spacious and more well used at the time. But there was also the offices of the church. Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, the High Council, the Elders' Quorum, all of those individuals had offices inside the temple as well that they utilized. So at the time, they had one building they were building, but it fulfilled several functions at the same time. Those who understand the history understand this time that the endowment had yet not taken on its form. The commandment to build the Nauvoo Temple, as recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants was given specifically to house a place to do baptisms for the dead, a new doctrine that was not previously known and understood at Kirtland. And so the temple was the area where the focus was given for these baptisms. As soon as the first floor or the basement was complete and the floor above it was in place, they had dedicated the font ready for baptism. Proxy work had begun immediately. They had indicated that the Lord had allowed baptisms for the dead in the Mississippi River. And as soon as that temple was ready and operable, he wanted it to stop and be done in the temple. So we know that although the temple in itself was specific, a house of the Lord, the function and use of the temple was evolving. It evolved from Kirtland, and it was evolving to when the saints arrived in Salt Lake. They had finished the St. George Temple, very similar, these big assembly rooms with multiple offices. When Brigham Young was holding his winter quarters in St. George, when he was living there, he held the church functions in the St. George Temple when he was away from Salt Lake. And so they worked that way. It wasn't until Manti and Logan and Salt Lake came along that now that the focus of the temple and the program, that term I used earlier, now the endowment was taking center stage as a main center place for how the temple was assembled. And so we see a departure from Kirtland, Nauvoo, and St. George into these modern temples that we all know and understand today.
Well, now the current Kirtland Temple is owned and operated by the Community of Christ.
Correct.
Or formerly known as the Reorganized LDS Church. Does the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, have any involvement with the Kirtland Temple today?
No, not that I'm aware of. I can't speak in behalf of their church, but when we were doing research on the Nauvoo Temple, we took a field trip back there to Kirtland. There was a Latter-day Saint engineer living in Kent, Ohio, that wrote a book on the Kirtland Temple. He was hired by the Community of Christ to do a structural analysis of the building. And in our conversations with him and many of the caretakers there, they were pretty implicit about saying that any restoration work done on the Kirtland Temple was done by funds from the Community of Christ and not by any help from the LDS Church. I think there is some underlying feeling that they wanted nothing to do in that regard for any financial help, and I think that's been kind of their mindset of that time. Of course, most of the visitors that go back to Kirtland, and they would be the first ones to admit this, are Latter-day Saints from various places around the world. And the members of the Community of Christ love that building, who take care of it, and they're happy to take our members through the building. But the sad thing that they even mention themselves, that their own members don't have an understanding or understand the significance of that building, even to them. And they were even disheartened by that truth as well.
What about with the Nauvoo Temple? Did you get a sense that there was any interest from the Reorganized Church or the Community of Christ in the rebuilding of the Nauvoo Temple?
I try to make a personal effort, because there's members of the Reorganized Church that were living in Nauvoo at the time we were living there. And I befriended one of their members down at the Joseph Smith Center, which is their version of the visitor center for their church. And I had this very question I asked him. And I says, "What does it mean to you?" And he says, "Absolutely nothing." And I was really taken back by that. I says, "Well, I find that surprising, because I thought I know we have a lot of differences between us, but I thought we share a common heritage." He says, "Not at all." I says, "Well, help me understand that." And he says, "We believe," and I don't know if this is him speaking or he was speaking as a member of the as the church as a wide, but they believe that there was a timetable, and it is described in the Doctrine and Covenants that the Lord said He would reject it if the saints were not expeditious in finishing this temple. And then when he said that, I says, "Do you believe the Lord rejected it?" He says, "Absolutely. We believe the Lord rejected it. There's no need for temples anymore. That's why our temple in Independence is so much different than yours. It's more Protestant in that regard with his main sanctuary." So at least from his perspective, he wasn't interested at all. I even personally invited him. I says, "I will give you a tour, bring you up when time is ready." He says, "I'm not interested." And I would take that maybe his personal take. I don't know if all of them felt that way, but I was taken back by that response. I really thought there would be something common between us. There wasn't.
Well, that's very interesting. But what about just the locals in Nauvoo? What kind of experience did you have working with them during the construction?
Well, as a temporary resident of Nauvoo, I did get to know and understand that they were very careful of us. They were a little fearful that maybe we'd all come back and take over the city again. This is their small town. This is to them is their where they grew up. And, of course, they realize there's significance historically. But, Nauvoo at the time was a town of 900 people. It wasn't a very large community. And they didn't want it to change. I don't think that's probably any different than any other community in the nation where something significant comes to happen. They don't want to see their way of life go. So there were some, concerns in that regard. And maybe vocally expressed at city council. I know there were times where the residents were very, very concerned that their life and the way they've known it would change forever. I would be happy to report after we were all finished and everything was done that immediately when it was finished, there was even a subsidence of those feelings. They recognized how wonderful the temple was to them and what it did to their community. It was an absolutely rejuvenation of their community in terms of its fabric and what it meant. So they realized the importance of it. There was some fear that maybe people would come, but today maybe there has been, but it's still a small town and it's still Nauvoo and nothing has really changed. So I know that there were some early concerns, and I suspect you'll get people's opinion. I know there were some that were vocal opponents of it, but for the most part, the ones that I knew, they were happy for it.
I can imagine it's increased the property value.
Yeah, it has in some regards, not hugely. At the time when we were living there, was a huge economic depression going on. There was almost 14% unemployment rate going on in that area, and there was no jobs to be found. And so for anything, they thought of it as a boon for tourism. And yes, I do know of people going in and speculating, buying property, doing other things. That kind of activity does increase the value of the property of the area.
Well, so let's talk about when the temple was originally there and just walk us through the history. Where did it go? How is it that it just disappeared?
Well, I'll tell you from my perspective of what I understand. I know a lot of the members see artwork and other depictions of the temple burning as the saints were leaving the area. That's far from the truth. The building was burned, but it was well after the saints had left and gone to Canesville and to winter quarters. If people understand the history, in 1844, the prophet was martyred in June of that year. 1842 is when it commenced, and 1846 is when it was dedicated. And by that time, people were already preparing to leave and move on to Iowa and Nebraska. And so it was a very hastening of that fact. But it was so early in the year of 1846, members were getting their endowments. They were preparing to leave. They were leaving Nauvoo. By summer, everyone had pretty much left. And it was a couple months after that that the building was burned by arson, by people who hated the church. And from that point on, we don't understand where the title of the church went. I do know that the Brigham Young was interested in selling it when he had heard about it burning. He was glad of it in some regard because he didn't want anyone that didn't understand and understand the sacredness of that building would defile it. And so there was some relief that it probably had perished in some regard, but it also, on the psyche of the church, it hit everyone pretty hard. So my understanding from that time, from the saints leaving and going to Salt Lake Valley and staying here, the church had lost contact with the property. There were other groups that came in and took ownership of it. There was a group called the Icarians that came from France that occupied the site for a while. After it was burned down, it was just a hole of a building. They were trying to improve the structure by building its foundations again. While they were there, a tornado came down and destroyed three walls of the building and left the front part of the temple without the roof on in ruins. And so the Icarians left the temple site. They took and scavenged the building stone and built a schoolhouse, some apartment buildings, and the stone found its way into many people's wine cellars, building for their homes as well. It was a lot of building products, so it went throughout the whole community. And today you can go to people's homes. I visited some people's homes where in their wine cellar they had a portion of the sunstone. It was pretty funky. And it's been there for 100 years. And just the way in the fabric of the community. And so it wasn't until the 30s, a faithful member by the name of Wolford Wood went and tried to recuperate many of the church's lost properties, not just Nauvoo, but many other church sites as well. He was successful in purchasing the property for $900. At the time, that was a significant amount of money, and that was for the main property, but there were several other purchases to actually get the whole entire block back, which the church was successful in doing. And the church held property for many years. Up until about the 1960s, Nauvoo was pretty much in ruins. There were many, many of the early church church historical figures that had homes there, other properties. And a man by the name of Dr. Leroy Kimball came in, who was a descendant of Heber C. Kimball, found his forebears' property there in ruins and bought it, restored it. It invigorated him. He wanted to do more. So he founded what was called Nauvoo Restoration, Inc., and they single-handedly went and bought and restored many of the church sites. And if you go back there today, there's probably a dozen properties that the church has restored. Well, through Nauvoo, Inc., it was a private group at the time. Later, since that time, the church has taken control of Nauvoo Restoration. But the 70s Hall, the Browning Home, the Brigham Young Home, several other beautiful homes that have been able to be saved because of their efforts. And that's kind of the precursor to the Nauvoo Temple in 1999 when President Hinckley announced its building.
Well, I visited Nauvoo in about 1994. I remember going there and kind of seeing the sort of rough outline of where the foundation was, and they had a sunstone there under glass. Between that point and 1999, when President Hinckley announced that it would be rebuilt, do you know what the thought process was? What kind of things led up to that announcement?
None that I was aware of, from at least President Hinckley's mind. I know it took a lot of people by surprise. The people we worked with, the architects and project managers of the church, were all surprised. There was one architect we worked with, Bob Dewey, who in an earlier life had done a lot of historical research on the temple. He was given the project the next day and say, let's get going. And they were all caught by surprise by President Hinckley's announcement. I think it was a big shock to many people. And so I don't know what was on President Hinckley's mind. I do know his father, Bryant Hinckley, was the mission president in the Chicago Mission, which at the time included Nauvoo. And I knew he wanted to build the temple as well. So I suspect there were many conversations in the family about this rebuilding of the temple. And I think forever, and at least in history, we'll think of Nauvoo Temple as the temple that President Hinckley was able to restore. As Brigham's Temple in Salt Lake, I know that President Hinckley called it Joseph's Temple, which it was, but I think others would fondly think of President Hinckley and his ability to envision to restore that building.
So once the announcement's made, how is it that you were brought into the project?
I was fairly young at the time. I was in my early 30s. My employer, my friend and boss, Roger Jackson, was the main force behind the contract of getting the temple from the LDS Church. But at the time, it was just the restoration, historical forensic work. It wasn't the actual rebuilding of the temple. That part of it was already given to another architect at the time. By good fortune and a blessing to us that I'll be always grateful for, we were eventually able to give the whole entire project. But for 4 months, from about April to about October, is that 4 months? It's not quite 4 months, but end of September, beginning of September into October, we were doing all this restoration historical research work. So 4 or 5 months we were doing that, and then October, the contractor, Legacy Contractors, which was a consortium of Jacobson, Layton, and Oakland, contractors were brought together to build this project. They just came off of the conference center as a successful contracting team building that temple, and they were brought on to do the work for us. So our historical research project turned into get it done. Let's get the new temple going. So we were spending all that time doing all the research work, all the kind of forensic architectural work that was required to get the building going. We thought it would be a year and a half work, and we were only given a couple months on it.
What kind of background work did you do to form the basis for your work on the Nauvoo Temple?
Well, we had very little to go on. We had an archaeological report done by J.C. Harrington in the 1960s. So we knew basically some of the rooms of what they could have looked like. We knew where the font was. We knew exactly what that. And we had some drawings from William Weeks that were found by two missionaries in the 1940s, which is a fascinating story in and of itself, because William Weeks at the time was the architect, had the drawings with him, came to Salt Lake with the rest of the saints, but because of some disagreements he had, fell out of favor and was excommunicated. He later rebaptized, but found himself not staying with the saints in Salt Lake and left for California, with him taking the drawings in the Nauvoo Temple. Well, these were not in the church's hands up until the 1940s, when two missionaries serving in the Mojave Desert came upon his descendants. And through contact and a relationship of trust they set with that family, before one of the elders came home to Salt Lake, the grandson of William Weeks brought to the missionary, said, "Here's my grandfather's work. I want you to take it back to Salt Lake and let them know that this is a donation from us to them." And he was able to bring those back to Salt Lake. We had the benefit of seeing these drawings, beautiful drawings, but in terms of recreating the temple in a whole was grossly inadequate. We basically had a beautiful elevation of the west side of the building that I think many people have seen. It's a measured drawing, had beautiful notes on it. We had wonderful details of the tower and all the architectural moldings that were going on there.
Well, at the top of the tower, there was a weather vane.
And there was a weather vane.
Right, and that was what was depicted in that weather vane.
And we actually had the drawing of that as well. It was a specific drawing, but it was an angel recumbent, which means to say that he was kind of in a kind of flying attitude. Didn't have wings, with a trumpet to his mouth, a book of scripture in its hand. We take to be a signification of Moroni, but in a different way than we've ever seen him before. So all this was part of it. So we had really good details where we had it, but we didn't have the east elevation. We didn't have interior details of a floor plan even. We had a corner of a framing plan, which showed the staircase, but we didn't even know, how, other than what the saints left in their journals, we didn't know how the building was arranged. So we did a lot of forensic work in terms of journals, but one of the challenges with journals, everyone remembers it slightly different. And for the most part, we had a basic understanding of what was required of us, but we didn't have the full picture. So I would say the William Weeks drawings, the archaeological research work, and then we had two daguerreotypes. There were several, but two of them were of note, the Thomas Easterly daguerreotype and the Louis Chafin daguerreotype. And that when I mentioned daguerreotype, this was a name of an early photographic process, basically taking glass with some very caustic chemicals being applied to it. Shutters open, shutters closed. You take that glass, you develop it using mercury vapors and other caustic materials, and you're able to get basically a negative. And the Louis Chafin daguerreotype is about 2.5 inches by 4 inches. It's very small, maybe even smaller than that. I've seen it, and it's extremely small, but the detail is exquisite. Even after all these years, it was really well taken care of. So we had two of those, and there's also another photographic process called a tintype. So the daguerreotypes were done on glass. The tintype was done on tin, and that one was of the ruins of the west elevation, and beautifully detailed. We were able to glean a lot of information out of it. The sunstones, the ones that are surviving today, none of them have the nose intact. They're all been knocked off. And here we were able to see them and understand what they were able to do, so we were able to give them the sculptors. So with those tools, we were able to recreate things. And one of our architects on our team, Tim Maxwell, who was a historical architect who worked with NRI back in the 60s, took a lot of these things and did what's called a reverse perspective. So he would take the photograph, and as badly as it was at the time, and did a reverse perspective off of it and did a measured floor plan. And it wasn't very good because the original photograph was distorted. But it was fascinating that we were able to reverse that and actually show exactly what the building looked like at the time. And the direction you're looking at and the openings in the windows that he was able to see. So we were very detailed, trying to get back to the very information that we could to build what we had. And that became the basis of the restoration of the temple.
So now, if you go there today and you look up at the Nauvoo Temple, you're not going to see a weather vane at the top. Why is that?
Well, we had it in our drawings all the way along to restore the weather vane. And I think it made it through probably three-quarters of the project, maybe half the project because it took time. And then one day we were asked and instructed to not move forward with the weather vane. We even had a local artist.
So was it originally approved?
It was. We had a local artist, Carl Quilter, who did one of the modern Moronis that you see on many of our temples. He did a mock-up for us. We took it up. It was approved. We went forward with it. But then we had word that President Hinckley wanted to see a standing angel. And, of course, he's spoken himself about why he did that. And kind of in summary, his basic understanding was, you know, here's the historical temple, here's the modern temple. And he felt the best appropriate use of the new temple was to do this, the modern Moroni rather than the recumbent Moroni. Because in all senses of the words, this is a new building. It looks like the original. So the second reincarnation of this building, in fact, the only difference you'd see on it today would be the Moroni on top.
So other than that, as far as you can tell, the exterior of the building looks just like it did originally.
As much as we understood. And I could say without reservation that all the detailing that we had information on was exquisite and exact replication of what we understood.
Now, if somebody goes into the Nauvoo Temple today, it's going to be different than what the original saints would have seen. How did you approach the interior?
Well, of course, as we discussed earlier, Kirtland, Nauvoo, and St. George were intended for a different function. They were meant for early worship on Sundays, on further sacrament meetings and other things. Not until did we get to Logan, Manti, and St. Salt Lake did we understand that the temple now had the focus of the endowment. So if you go to St. George today, you're not going to see it looking like Kirtland. You're going to see it like a modern functioning temple with endowment rooms. And so because of this being a fully functional temple, it could no longer look like it did historically. It had to function as a modern functioning temple. So we had great license in terms of what it looked like originally to what it needed to look like today. So we came up with floor plans and working with the church architects and other designers and came up with a functioning modern temple. The only part that probably is historically accurate in terms of what it was like was probably the baptismal font in its location. And we have an assembly room on the first floor that is slightly smaller than it would have been historically, but that has been recreated as well to be what it was like. But other than that, it has a endowment rooms, has a celestial room, has marriage sealing rooms, and has all those functioning items in it as well.
What kind of efforts did you make to give the interior a feel of the period?
Yeah, so based on what we knew of the time, and there's many examples of what the people did, when they were building of the time that the designs of that time were ubiquitous. They had what they call pattern books at the time that many of the local builders were building from. So we even have those today, and we were able to go to them, look at some of the things they were looking at, and we were able to take some of the designs. And I have to admit, some of the drawings we had from William Weeks were random. But we had a base profile. We knew he was looking at this. So we recreated that. On the inside, we had window surrounds. And there was a picture of that in his drawings. And it had, you know, you see this characteristically beautiful sunstone on the outside. Well, he had this other very beautiful drawing of what we took as an interior detail. And we kind of nicknamed it the peekaboo sun. Because the one on the outside, the sun is fully faced, has a mouth and nose kind of stuff. But on the inside, there's this detail of the sun just rising, peaking above the clouds. It's very beautiful. And that was original. We didn't know exactly what to use it for, but we used it as an interior window surround. So some of those things we understood, but everything else was of the time period. It would have been done by people living at that time. So if you were to visit today, you'd feel like I've been in a historic building. And we use wood floors. One of the most beautiful parts of the temple is the spiral staircase without a center support. So this kind of twisting, beautiful ascending staircase, you can see from top to bottom. It's magnificent. And it would have been exactly like that from the original temple as well. We see something very similar in the Manti temple as well.
So the Nauvoo temple had that ascending staircase in it,
yes,
that we see in the Manti temple today.
Absolutely.
Wow. And architecturally, that doesn't exist in very many places anywhere. I remember going to the United States Supreme Court building, and it has that type of staircase, and they commented on that about how...
How difficult.
Well, not just difficult, but that one existed in the Manti Temple of the Mormon Church. And as I recall... They made a comment about how unusual it was in architecture to have that kind of a staircase. Are you familiar with that?
Not in the sense that you brought up. That's actually a new idea that I hadn't heard before. I'd believe it, because other than the St. George Tabernacle, which has smaller ones, but they only go not as high, I've never seen that ever built before. And it is magnificent. It's part of the charm of the building. It's one of the things that I hear most commonly when people go visit a temple, how beautiful and exquisite that staircase is. It's a part of the experience as a patron going into the temple. I will note, as an interesting kind of anecdote, that all of the converts that were being brought, that were assembling in Nauvoo, were the efforts and fruits of the missionaries in Europe. And these people that they were bringing to the church, they were being converted, were skilled craftsmen from Germany, Scandinavia, all parts of Europe, and they brought with them all these trades with them. And there's many examples of all these beautiful building types all throughout the kind of the Mountain West, from tabernacles that are all products of these talented individuals. These were people working on the Nauvoo Temple, and they were taught in Europe. They were taught by people that knew all these beautiful arts, and maybe in some kind of a unique way, the church was able to capitalize on all those wonderful talents.
Now, in order to rebuild the temple, it was necessary to re-excavate the site. Were there any significant archaeological finds from the original Nauvoo temple discovered during the excavation for the new temple?
Other than what was uncovered by the original archaeologists, there were some foundation stones. There were some charred remains of the building. That was there. Of course, that was raised once we start digging into it. The one thing that probably hadn't been seen before was the baptismal drain. From where the font was, there was an actual drain that was taken off-site so the water could be drained and maintained as it needed to be. And we were able to find that, and it was still intact.
Now, as you developed the plans and the drawings and what you're going to do, what kind of instructions were you given, and how much oversight was there of your work?
Well, we had some scholars of sorts. Richard Oman, an art historian, some producers that had done some early historical research on the Nauvoo Temple from the film Legacy, and some others that were book scholars that had been writing stuff on Nauvoo. They were kind of our conscience and kind of our guiding star for any of the research we came up with. Anything new that we found, we'd talk to them about, and they'd give us their feedback. And beyond that, we didn't have any other oversight, and we were kind of free to express, and basically our original directions were to build and recreate the temple as close as possible. And that kind of marching order was always brought back, making sure that whatever we did was for that purpose.
Were there any original materials used from the original temple in the temple that's there now?
Unfortunately, no. The stone that we had on the new Nauvoo temple was not even from the original quarries that they had there. We found, sadly, that the quarries that were being utilized for limestone at the time were being used for gravel for roads and for cement. And the process of removing that from the ground is very, very violent. They'll use explosives to break loose the material that has a tendency to destroy the strata and is not good for building stone. So we weren't able to use it other than the fact we'd have to open up our new quarry, and the church was not interested in doing that. We actually had to go to another source for the stone. Other than what you see on the outside, everything else is a modern functioning building. There was nothing used that was done anciently, historically.
So we have the Nauvoo Temple. There were other temple sites that have been dedicated by the Prophet Joseph Smith.
Correct.
There were plans laid out. There was the Plat of Zion that was laid out by Joseph Smith. What do you know about that?
Well, other than what many others know, I'm probably not the most qualified to discuss the details of that, but it depicted what Joseph had considered, you know, what Zion would be, and it was basically an extremely large city. But curiously, at the center of the city were 24 temples. And these temples, we don't know the function of what they would have been, but in my mind, and, you know, as someone who's worked on these temples for a long time, knowing that the purpose for each temple is not always specific to any one purpose. We know anciently, from Moses' time, that the temple had a slightly different function in terms of how it was arranged. I mean, we do have scriptures that indicate that most likely the endowment's always been understood and been practiced. But in terms of how the temples were arranged, there has been slight variations on that plan. So what Joseph Smith and Brigham Young used early on in the church, it was a temple, it was a meeting house, it was offices for the church. I suspect there'll be temples in the future be used for other purposes as well.
Well, and the Nauvoo Temple was used as a social gathering place for some occasions.
In their journals, they talked about having dances in the temple as well.
Right, and so there's some indication that the way in which we use temples may evolve in the future. It has evolved in the past. The way in which the ordinances are presented has evolved over time. You know, it's exciting to think about how things may change in the future and how our understanding of the significance of temples may evolve and how we can gain an appreciation for that. So as you think back on your experience with the Nauvoo Temple in particular, and I guess all of your work helping to design temples and some of our sacred buildings, what kind of experiences, maybe unique experiences, have you had that you feel like you could share?
Well, particularly with Nauvoo, it was probably a really unique experience. When we were finished, a few of us were gathered together to kind of give out an oral history. It was something that President Hinckley had asked of Keith Steppen, who was the managing director of the temple building project at the time. And so he asked the same question. Anything significant? And it didn't actually hit me until he had asked the question that many of us that lived there in Nauvoo had experienced this. Now, anyone who's been to Nauvoo realize how small of a community it is. And so those of us that went there to work basically had a huge impact on the population of the city during that time period when we were there. And so many of the people I worked with, we would gather in the mornings to have a devotional. We'd pray, we'd sing a hymn, give a thought, and we would work, go out throughout the day. On the weekends, we would have social activities. And on Sunday, we would worship together on Sunday. And in my experience, I don't think I've had that close of contact with the same individuals on that level at any time in my life before. And it almost gave me kind of a feeling of what Zion might have been like. That we had this kind of common friendship, a work relationship, and a spiritual connection that we were able to connect with in all aspects of our life. And many of us today still congregate and gather together like a mission reunion. There were some very special times. So in some regards, I felt like I had experienced a slight Zion experience. albeit much more different than I suspect it was intended, but there was a closeness and a kind of a spirituality that existed among the group that was unique that I've never felt before. And in some regard, I hope and feel in my heart that maybe that consecration, that effort that I give would be received by the Lord as my ancestors did when they originally built the temple many years ago.
Well, that's one of the purposes of the temples, isn't it? To help us to develop an attitude of consecration and unity and love, and you know, being knit together with one heart and one mind. You know, so it's exciting to me to hear about how you sort of experienced that type of a change of heart as you worked together with people to build the temple. And it's exciting to me, the thought of going back and seeing it now. I haven't been back to Nauvoo since the temple has been rebuilt. I'm looking forward to doing that and looking forward to worshiping in the temple. I appreciate your thoughts on this, and I think our listeners will too. I appreciate you spending the time with
us,
Stephen,
and appreciate
that. Mormon Faircast. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you like this podcast, you can help promote it by subscribing to it in iTunes and by rating it and writing a review. Post a link on your blog and Facebook page and tell your friends about us. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Michael R. Ashe is the author of the book Shaken Faith Syndrome, Strengthening One's Testimony in the Face of Criticism and Doubt, as well as the book Of Faith and Reason, 80 Evidences Supporting the Prophet Joseph Smith. Both books are available for purchase online through the Fair Bookstore. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Lawrence Green. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the views of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of Fair.